A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about foods and condiments that should always be kept out of children's reach. Not the obvious stuff like bleach under the sink, but edible things. Salt, soy sauce, the stuff in your kitchen that looks harmless but isn't. The question is basically, what's actually dangerous and what's parental paranoia?
This is one of those topics where the gap between what people worry about and what the data says is genuinely fascinating. Most parents I talk to are terrified of their kid eating a dishwasher pod, but will leave a bottle of soy sauce on the dinner table without a second thought.
The colorful detergent pod versus the brown liquid that smells like dinner. One of those is a known hazard. The other just seems like...
And that's the whole problem. Let's start with salt because it's the one that surprises people most. The lethal dose for a toddler is shockingly low, roughly half a teaspoon per pound of body weight. For a one-year-old weighing 20 pounds, that's about 10 teaspoons, which sounds like a lot until you realize severe toxicity can start at far less than the lethal dose.
So, less than a quarter cup. Which any curious toddler with a salt shaker could absolutely consume before you notice they've been quiet for too long.
Here's the thing. Salt poisoning in children isn't theoretical. There was a case in South Carolina a few years back where a mother was convicted after her 17-month-old died from sodium poisoning. The child had been fed about 6 teaspoons of salt. The medical examiner said the sodium levels were equivalent to what you'd see in someone who'd been lost at sea and drinking seawater.
That is grim. But it also points to something. The danger isn't just a kid grabbing the salt shaker. It's also about what adults might do. A grandparent who thinks a little extra salt makes the food taste better. A well-meaning sibling.
And the symptoms in a child are deceptively subtle at first. Extreme thirst, restlessness, then lethargy, eventually seizures. By the time it's obvious something is seriously wrong, the brain swelling may already be significant. The sodium pulls water out of cells through osmosis. The brain literally shrinks, and then when you rehydrate too quickly, it can swell catastrophically.
The mechanism is basically desiccation from the inside out. I'm a sloth. I know about slow things, and I know about dry things.
Now let's talk about soy sauce, because this is the poster child for this category. Soy sauce is essentially liquid salt with flavor. A single tablespoon contains about 900 milligrams of sodium, roughly 40% of an adult's daily recommended intake.
For a toddler?
A toddler's daily sodium limit is about 1,000 milligrams total. So one tablespoon and they're at their entire day's allowance. But the acute danger is far worse. There was a case in Virginia in 2013. A 19-year-old man drank a quart of soy sauce as a fraternity there. He went into a coma, had seizures, and nearly died. His blood sodium level hit 196 milliequivalents per liter. Normal is 135 to 145.
A quart is obviously extreme, but scale that down. A toddler gets their hands on one of those little takeout packets, or a bottle with a loose cap.
A single takeout packet is about 2 teaspoons. For a 15-pound infant, that's enough to cause dangerous sodium elevation, not necessarily lethal, but enough to warrant an emergency room visit. And soy sauce bottles are particularly problematic because they're often kept on the table within reach, and the caps aren't childproof.
Also, it tastes good. A kid might actually keep drinking it. Unlike, say, vinegar, which is self-limiting because it's unpleasant.
That's a really important distinction. Self-limiting versus non-self-limiting hazards. Vinegar, particularly cleaning strength, can cause esophageal burns, but most kids will spit it out immediately. Soy sauce is savory and complex. A child might actively consume it.
What about other high-sodium condiments?
Fish sauce is arguably worse than soy sauce. Higher sodium concentration plus the histamine content can trigger allergic-like reactions. In Southeast Asian kitchens, it's a staple that sits on the counter. Oyster sauce is thick and sweet, which makes it more appealing, and it's still extremely high in sodium.
We've got a category here. Liquid salt bombs that taste good enough to keep drinking. Soy sauce, fish sauce, oyster sauce, tamari. Liquid aminos.
Liquid aminos is a good call-out because people think it's the healthy alternative. It's still extremely high in sodium. The health halo is misleading. And while we're on condiments, let's talk about hot sauce.
That feels self-limiting to me. One taste and most kids are done.
You'd think so, but capsaicin tolerance varies wildly. And more importantly, the danger with hot sauce isn't ingestion, it's contact. A child gets it on their hands, rubs their eyes, and suddenly you've got corneal irritation that requires an eye wash and possibly urgent care. Also, some extract-based hot sauces, Scoville ratings in the hundreds of thousands, can actually cause chemical burns on sensitive skin.
The super concentrated ones that come with warning labels.
Those aren't food anymore. They're food-adjacent chemical irritants, and they're often sold in small, colorful bottles that look fun. A 5-year-old sees a tiny bottle with a cartoon pepper on it. They're curious.
Okay, let's shift categories. What about choking hazards? Because that's probably the biggest actual risk in the kitchen.
It absolutely is. The American Academy of Pediatrics says anything round, firm, and about the diameter of a child's airway, roughly the size of a grape, is a choking risk. Grapes themselves, cherry tomatoes, large blueberries, olives, hot dog coins, mozzarella balls, hard candies, nuts, seeds, popcorn, raw carrots.
Hot dog coins. That's a specific shape problem.
Hot dogs are one of the leading causes of food-related choking deaths in children. The shape is perfectly cylindrical, compressible enough to lodge tightly, and exactly the diameter of a toddler's trachea. The recommendation is to slice hot dogs lengthwise first, then into small pieces.
Grapes. You're supposed to quarter them.
Quarter them lengthwise, not halve them. A half grape is still a perfect plug for an airway. This is one of those things where the guidance has gotten stricter as the data has accumulated.
What about things that aren't obvious? Popcorn always surprises me.
Popcorn is a triple threat. It's light enough to be inhaled accidentally during a laugh or a cry, irregularly shaped so it can lodge unpredictably, and the kernels are hard enough to cause damage if aspirated into the lungs. Plus, the hulls can get stuck and cause infection. Most pediatricians recommend no popcorn until age 4 at minimum.
Nuts and seeds.
Hard, small, irregular, easily inhaled. Peanuts and sunflower seeds are particularly bad because they're the exact size to block a bronchus. And nut butters are a separate issue. A thick glob of peanut butter can completely obstruct an airway because it conforms to the shape of the throat and doesn't break apart. That's why you thin it out or spread it very lightly for young kids.
The choking hazard list. Grapes, cherry tomatoes, olives, hot dogs, popcorn, nuts, seeds, hard candies, gum, marshmallows, raw carrots, raw apples, chunks of meat, chunks of cheese.
Anything with small bones. Chicken wing bones. Kids don't have the oral dexterity to detect and remove them.
Let's talk about the chemical dangers that are food adjacent. Vanilla extract, almond extract.
This is a big one that parents overlook. Vanilla extract is 35% alcohol by volume. That's 70 proof. A small bottle has roughly the same alcohol content as a shot of vodka. A toddler drinking a tablespoon is consuming a significant dose of alcohol relative to their body weight.
It smells like cookies. It's literally designed to be appealing.
Almond extract is even stronger, up to 40% alcohol, and it also contains benzaldehyde, which in very large quantities can be toxic. Lemon extract, orange extract, peppermint extract, same deal. These are bottles of flavored ethanol sitting in your spice cabinet.
What about cooking wines? Sherry, mirin, rice wine?
Cooking wine is deliberately salted to make it unpalatable for drinking, which makes the sodium content the secondary danger. But mirin and rice wine are sweet and relatively low in alcohol, still enough to be a problem for a small child, but the bigger risk is that they look like juice, clear or golden liquid in a bottle. A child sees it in the fridge door and thinks it's apple juice.
The fridge door is actually a recurring theme here. Condiments, extracts, cooking wines. These all live at kid height.
That's a design problem nobody talks about. The standard refrigerator puts the most dangerous food items. Condiments, alcohol, extracts, leftover containers with choking hazards at the perfect height for a 2-year-old. The crisper drawers at their feet. The door shelves are eye level.
The advice is basically, move the condiments up.
Move them up or get a fridge lock. And fridge locks are annoying for adults, but they're effective.
What about honey? That's one I always heard about with infants.
Honey is a fascinating case because it's not toxic in the conventional sense. The danger is botulism spores. Honey can contain Clostridium botulinum spores, which are harmless to adults and older children because our gut microbiome outcompetes them. But an infant's digestive system, under 12 months, doesn't have the established flora to prevent the spores from germinating and producing botulinum toxin.
It's basically a microbial land grab. The spores find empty territory and set up shop.
And infant botulism is terrifying. It starts with constipation, then progressive muscle weakness, the baby goes floppy, loses head control, has trouble feeding, and eventually can't breathe. Recovery takes weeks or months in the hospital. There are about 100 cases a year in the United States, and honey is the only food source that's been definitively linked.
It's specifically raw or unpasteurized honey, or all honey.
Pasteurization doesn't kill botulism spores. They're extremely heat resistant. So the rule is absolute, no honey before 12 months. Not in food, not on a pacifier, not in baked goods.
What about maple syrup?
Those don't carry the botulism risk, but they're still concentrated sugars that shouldn't be given to infants. The bigger practical danger with syrups is the bottle. A child gets hold of a quart of maple syrup, unscrews the cap, drinks a bunch. Now you're dealing with an enormous sugar load, possible vomiting, diarrhea, and a spectacularly sticky mess.
The mess might be the most immediate crisis.
Having cleaned maple syrup off a kitchen floor, I can confirm it's a multi-day project.
Let's pivot to allergens, because that's a different kind of out-of-reach question. It's not about keeping the food away from the child in the moment. It's about whether the food should be in the house at all.
This is where the paradigm has shifted dramatically in the last decade. The old advice was strict avoidance. Don't introduce peanuts until age 3. Keep all allergenic foods out of the house. The new understanding, driven largely by the LEAP study published in 2015, is that early introduction of allergens actually prevents allergies from developing. Learning early about peanut allergy. A randomized controlled trial with over 600 infants at high risk for peanut allergy. They found that introducing peanuts between 4 and 11 months reduced the rate of peanut allergy by up to 86% compared to avoidance. That's enormous. It changed pediatric guidelines worldwide.
The parents who were meticulously keeping peanut butter out of their homes were actually increasing the risk.
They were following the best advice available at the time, but yes, that advice was wrong. The current recommendation is to introduce peanuts, eggs, milk, wheat, soy, fish, shellfish, tree nuts, and sesame early and often. Once introduced and tolerated, keep them in the regular rotation.
That's for prevention. If a child already has a diagnosed allergy, then you're back to keeping those foods out of reach or out of the house entirely.
And for severe allergies, particularly peanut and tree nut allergies, the threshold for a reaction can be vanishingly small. We're talking milligrams. A knife used to spread peanut butter, wiped off but not thoroughly washed, then used to make a sandwich for an allergic child. That cross contact can trigger anaphylaxis.
The kitchen becomes a contamination control zone.
Separate cutting boards, separate utensils, separate storage containers. Some families go entirely nut-free in the home. Others maintain a strict zone system. The psychological toll on parents is significant. Constant vigilance, reading every label, never quite relaxing at meals.
Let's talk about caffeine. Coffee, tea, energy drinks, chocolate.
Caffeine is a stimulant, and children metabolize it much more slowly than adults. A small amount of dark chocolate isn't going to send a child to the emergency room, but a toddler getting into coffee grounds or espresso beans is a different situation. Caffeine toxicity in children causes tachycardia, vomiting, tremors, and in severe cases, seizures.
What's the actual toxic dose?
About 15 milligrams per kilogram of body weight for moderate toxicity. For a 10-kilogram toddler, roughly 22 pounds, that's 150 milligrams of caffeine. A single espresso shot has about 63 milligrams. Two shots, and you're in trouble. A cup of brewed coffee has 95, and energy drinks can have 200 to 300 milligrams per can.
Caffeine pills, which some households have.
One caffeine pill is typically 200 milligrams. For a toddler, that's a potentially lethal dose. Those need to be treated like medication, locked up, completely inaccessible.
Chocolate deserves more attention here. Dark chocolate in particular.
Dark chocolate contains both caffeine and theobromine, the same compound that makes chocolate toxic to dogs. Humans metabolize theobromine efficiently, but children are slower at it. An ounce of dark chocolate, 70% cacao or higher, contains about 20 milligrams of caffeine and roughly 150 milligrams of theobromine. It would take quite a lot to cause serious toxicity, but a child eating an entire bar is going to be wired, nauseous, and possibly tachycardic.
The dog comparison is apt. People know chocolate is bad for dogs. Less awareness that its dose. Dependently problematic for small humans, too.
Baking chocolate is even more concentrated. Unsweetened baking chocolate has about 4 times the theobromine of dark chocolate. A single ounce is roughly 400 milligrams. That's enough to cause symptoms in a toddler.
Let's talk about sugar substitutes, xylitol in particular.
Xylitol is fascinating and terrifying. It's a sugar alcohol used in sugar-free gum, candies, some peanut butters, and increasingly in baked goods and ice creams marketed as low sugar. In humans, xylitol is fine. It doesn't spike blood sugar. It's good for dental health. In dogs, it causes a massive insulin release and fatal hypoglycemia. In children, large amounts can cause severe gastrointestinal distress, osmotic diarrhea, bloating, gas. A child eating a pack of sugar-free gum could end up with hours of cramping and diarrhea.
Not lethal, but deeply unpleasant.
Not lethal in children, no, but the other sugar alcohols, sorbitol, maltitol, erythritol, same deal with the GI effects. And these are in products that look exactly like regular candy. A child can't tell the difference between a sugar-free gummy bear and a regular one.
There's actually a whole genre of online reviews from people who ate a bag of sugar-free gummy bears without reading the label.
Those reviews are a public health resource in their own right.
What about nutmeg? I remember hearing something about nutmeg being psychoactive.
Nutmeg contains myristicin, a psychoactive compound at very high doses. The dose required for any psychoactive effect is also the dose that causes severe toxicity, nausea, vomiting, hallucinations, heart palpitations, and in extreme cases, organ failure. It takes about 2 to 3 whole nutmegs to produce effects, and the experience is universally described as miserable. A child eating a significant amount of ground nutmeg could absolutely end up in the emergency room.
It's not a prank or a dare substance. It's just poison at that level.
And the spice cabinet in general is underappreciated as a hazard. Cinnamon in large quantities can cause respiratory issues if inhaled. The cinnamon challenge. That was viral a decade ago, sent dozens of kids to the hospital with aspiration pneumonia. Clove oil is extremely concentrated and can cause liver damage. Even vanilla extract, which we already covered for the alcohol, contains vanillin, which in massive quantities can cause headaches and allergic reactions.
The spice cabinet is basically a pharmacy of unregulated bioactive compounds.
Spices are concentrated plant compounds. Many of them have real pharmacological effects. That's why they're used in traditional medicine. But that also means they have real toxicity at higher doses.
Okay, let's get practical. If a listener has young children at home, what's the actual checklist? What gets moved? What gets locked? What gets thrown out?
Tier 1. Absolute locks or removal. Any alcohol, any extracts, cooking wines, and anything in a bottle that looks drinkable. Soy sauce, fish sauce, and other high-sodium liquid condiments go in a high cabinet or behind a childproof latch. Caffeine products. Coffee, tea, energy drinks, caffeine pills. Locked up or completely inaccessible. Honey locked away if there's an infant under 12 months in the house. Hot sauces and extracts with high capsaicin content, same treatment. Tier 2. Relocation and supervision. Choking hazards like grapes, cherry tomatoes, hot dogs, nuts, popcorn, hard candies. These stay in the house, but are only served in age, appropriate forms under supervision. Nut butters are thinned for young children. The spice cabinet gets a childproof latch. Baking chocolate and dark chocolate move to a high shelf.
What about the fridge door?
The fridge door gets a lock or gets rearranged. Condiments move to the top shelf. Nothing in the door pockets except things that are harmless. Butter, yogurt tubes, cheese sticks. And even cheese sticks are a choking hazard if you're not careful.
What about things that parents worry about unnecessarily?
It's been demonized for decades based on essentially no good evidence. The Chinese restaurant syndrome thing was largely a racialized myth. MSG is just sodium and glutamate, both of which are in your body right now and in tons of natural foods. A child eating a spoonful of MSG powder might get thirsty from the sodium, but it's not acutely toxic in any meaningful way.
What about food coloring?
Artificial food colors have been studied extensively. There's some evidence that certain children with ADHD may be sensitive to specific dyes, particularly red 40 and yellow 5, but the effect is modest and inconsistent. A child drinking a bottle of food coloring would be alarming visually. Their diaper would be a science experiment, but acute toxicity is very low.
The brightly colored stuff is mostly fine, and the brown liquid that looks like nothing special is the real threat.
That's the irony. The visual cues we use to assess danger are completely inverted. Parrots see neon blue sports drinks and think chemicals, but the actual danger is in the amber bottle of vanilla extract that smells like grandma's baking.
What about raw dough? Cookie dough? Bread dough?
Two separate risks. Raw flour can carry E. coli. There was a major outbreak in 2016 linked to raw flour that hospitalized dozens. And raw eggs carry salmonella risk. But for children specifically, the bigger concern with raw bread dough is that the yeast can continue fermenting in the stomach, producing alcohol and causing bloating and potential obstruction. There are documented cases of dogs needing emergency surgery after eating raw bread dough, and the same physiology applies to small children.
The don't eat raw cookie dough rule isn't just about salmonella.
It's really not. And commercial edible cookie dough products exist now that use heat-treated flour and pasteurized eggs, which are safe. But homemade raw dough, keep it away from kids.
Let's talk about one more category. Things that aren't food, but look like food. Dishwasher pods, laundry pods, those colorful liquid-filled balls that look exactly like candy.
The laundry pod problem peaked around 2015 to 2017 when there was a genuine epidemic of children biting into them. The concentrated detergent causes chemical burns to the mouth and esophagus, and if aspirated, can cause severe lung damage. The industry responded by making pods less colorful and more opaque, and by introducing child-resistant packaging. But the hazard is still real.
The edible-looking cleaning products. The lemon-scented everything.
Anything that smells like food and comes in a spray bottle is a risk. Lemon furniture polish. Vanilla-scented candles. The olfactory cue says edible, even when the packaging says poison control.
Which brings us to the meta point. The real childproofing strategy isn't about identifying every individual hazard. It's about assuming that anything accessible will eventually be tasted, and securing accordingly.
That's the principle. Children explore the world orally. It's not a behavior problem, it's developmental biology. The mouth has more nerve endings than almost any other body part. It's the primary tool for investigating novel objects until about age 2. So the question isn't, will my child try to eat this? The question is, what happens when they do?
The answer, for a surprising number of pantry staples, is something between a bad afternoon and a trip to the ICU.
Which is why we're having this conversation. The kitchen is the most hazardous room in the house for a curious toddler, and most of the hazards are disguised as food.
To summarize the framework, and I know you love frameworks, we've got four categories. Acute toxins, salt, soy sauce, extracts, caffeine, nutmeg, honey for infants. Choking hazards, grapes, hot dogs, popcorn, nuts, hard candies. Allergens, situation dependent, but cross contact is the hidden risk. And the lookalikes, cleaning products that resemble food or drink.
That's a solid taxonomy. And I'd add a fifth, the dose-dependent hazards. Things that are fine in normal quantities but dangerous when a child consumes an entire container. Sugar-free candies with sugar alcohols. Even vitamin gummies. Those are basically candy that happens to contain iron. And iron overdose is one of the leading causes of poisoning deaths in young children.
The thing that's literally marketed as a healthy treat for kids.
They're often in bottles with child-resistant caps that aren't actually child-resistant once a 4-year-old figures out how to twist and press simultaneously, which they will. A full bottle of children's multivitamins with iron can contain a fatal dose of iron for a toddler.
The iron in those gummies is the real hazard.
Iron is fascinating because it's essential for life and acutely toxic in overdose. The body has no efficient way to excrete excess iron. It accumulates in the liver, heart, and pancreas, causing oxidative damage. A single large dose causes hemorrhagic gastroenteritis, vomiting blood, bloody diarrhea, and then a latent period where the child seems to recover, followed by cardiovascular collapse and liver failure.
That latent period is cruel. Parents think the worst is over.
It's one of the classic patterns in toxicology, the apparent recovery before the fatal crash. Iron, acetaminophen, certain mushrooms, they all have this biphasic course. You think you're in the clear, and then 24 to 48 hours later, the liver fails.
The practical takeaway, treat vitamin gummies like medication, not like snacks.
Treat anything that comes in a child-resistant bottle as medication, even if it tastes like a fruit snack. And keep the poison control number somewhere you can find it in 3 seconds.
What's the number?
In the U.S., it's 1-80222-12222, free, confidential, staffed by toxicology experts 24/7. Every parent should have it in their phone.
1-80222-12222. That's a lot of twos.
It's designed to be memorable, and they'd rather you call and it's nothing than not call and it's something.
That's a good principle for parenting in general, honestly.
It really is. The threshold for calling poison control should be extremely low. They're not going to judge you. They've heard everything. A kid eating a whole stick of butter, a kid drinking balsamic vinegar, a kid licking a bar of soap. They've heard it all.
I'm imagining the soap one. That's self-limiting in a very specific way.
Soap is actually low toxicity. It might cause some GI upset and you'll have a child blowing bubbles involuntarily for a while, but it's not going to cause serious harm. Which is another useful principle. The things that taste bad are usually less dangerous because the child stops consuming them.
The dangerous things are the ones that go down easy.
Salt dissolves imperceptibly on the tongue. Soy sauce is savory and rich. Vanilla extract smells heavenly. Honey is literally the archetype of sweetness. These are not things that trigger a rejection response. Evolution did not prepare us to detect sodium toxicity or alcohol concentration in a vanilla-scented liquid.
Evolution prepared us to find calories and salt, because for most of human history, those were scarce.
The very instincts that kept our ancestors alive are what make these modern concentrated food products dangerous. A Paleolithic child who found a salt deposit might lick it, but they weren't going to encounter a shaker of refined sodium chloride or a bottle of fermented soy extract.
The mismatch between our biology and our pantries.
That's the whole story. And childproofing is basically engineering a solution to that mismatch. Physical barriers to compensate for instincts that are poorly calibrated for a world of concentrated everything.
We've covered salt, soy sauce, fish sauce, extracts, honey, caffeine, chocolate, nutmeg, choking hazards, sugar alcohols, vitamin gummies, raw dough, and cleaning product lookalikes. Is there anything we're missing?
A few edge cases worth mentioning. Not a food, but it lives in the bathroom, and it's often brightly colored and minty. Many mouthwashes contain ethanol. Some are up to 27% alcohol. A child drinking a cup of mouthwash is consuming multiple shots of alcohol. Alcohol-free mouthwashes exist, but they contain other compounds that can cause GI upset.
It's at kid height next to the sink.
Right where they watch you use it every morning and evening. They see you put it in your mouth, and they want to imitate.
What about cooking oils? A toddler drinking olive oil?
Unlikely to cause acute harm, but a large amount of any oil can cause lipid pneumonia if aspirated into the lungs. And the laxative effect of drinking a cup of olive oil is not dangerous, but you'll be doing a lot of laundry.
What about the things that are safe? What can parents stop worrying about?
These are low risk. Ketchup is acidic and sugary, but not acutely toxic. Mustard might cause some mouth irritation from the vinegar and turmeric. Mayonnaise is just oil and eggs. The food poisoning risk is mostly a myth because commercial mayo is pasteurized and acidic enough to inhibit bacterial growth. Pickles are fine. Jam and jelly are fine. Most salad dressings are fine in the quantities a child would consume before getting bored.
The condiment shelf isn't uniformly dangerous. It's specifically the high sodium, high alcohol, and high capsaicin ones.
And the ones that look drinkable. A bottle of vinegar-based hot sauce in a glass bottle with a screw cap. That's a problem. A squeezed bottle of ketchup. Not a problem.
What about the organizational side of this? For a family setting up a kitchen with young kids, is there a system that works?
The system I've seen work best is a simple high-low divide. Everything below counter height is child-safe. Pots and pans, Tupperware, dish towels, unbreakable dishes. Everything above counter height requires an adult. The transition zone is the counter itself, where things can be temporarily placed during meal prep, but shouldn't be stored permanently.
The fridge follows the same logic.
Fridge door is the danger zone. Main shelves are safer because they're behind a door that can be locked. Freezer is generally fine. Frozen food isn't a consumption hazard for the most part, though freezer pops and ice packs can be choking risks.
What about the pantry?
Pantry needs a door lock or a gate. It's just too full of concentrated things in interesting packages. Even if you organize it perfectly, a determined toddler can find the one thing you forgot about.
The one thing you forgot about is always what they find.
It's a law of physics. Toddler uncertainty principle, you cannot simultaneously know the location of all hazards and the location of the toddler.
That's beautifully put.
I've been workshopping it.
All right, let's land this. If someone listening has young kids and wants to do a safety audit of their kitchen this weekend, what's the 30-minute checklist?
Walk the kitchen at toddler height. Literally, get on your knees. Look at what's visible and reachable from 30 inches off the ground. Open every cabinet and drawer within reach. If you find anything that's concentrated, bottled, and drinkable looking, move it up. If you find choking hazards, nuts, candies, popcorn, move them up. Check the fridge door for extracts, sauces, alcohols. Check under the sink for cleaning products. Lock it all. Put poison control in your phone.
30 minutes. Potentially life-saving.
The peace of mind is worth it. The mental load of constantly scanning for hazards is exhausting. Physical barriers reduce that load. You're not a bad parent for needing a lock on the spice cabinet. You're a smart parent for recognizing that vigilance is a limited resource.
Vigilance is a limited resource. That's the line of the episode.
I'll take it.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In ancient Rome, bronze cookware was prized for the ringing tone it produced when struck. Wealthy households would select pots and pans based on the purity of their acoustic resonance, believing that a clear tone indicated uncontaminated metal that wouldn't taint the food.
They were doing the spoon on the wine glass test, but for their entire kitchen.
The Romans invented the cookware sound check. Of course they did. So the open question I'm left with, and I think this is worth chewing on, is whether the current generation of parents is actually more safety conscious than previous ones, or just more anxious. The data on childhood injury and poisoning has trended down for decades, which suggests the interventions are working. But I wonder where the line is between reasonable precaution and a kind of ambient fear that makes the home feel like a minefield.
That's the tension. You want your kitchen to feel like a place of warmth and gathering, not a containment zone. And I think the answer is that good design makes safety invisible. A well-organized kitchen with hazards out of reach doesn't feel restrictive. It just feels like a kitchen. The fear comes from knowing the hazards are there and not being sure you've addressed them.
The goal isn't to eliminate risk. It's to eliminate uncertainty about risk.
Know what's dangerous, secure it, and then stop worrying. The rest is just cooking.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flemingdop. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
If you've got a question like this one, send it in. We'll do the research so you don't have to.
Until next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.